You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon from the Center on 21st Century Security and Intelligence. On behalf of my colleague, Peter Singer, who runs our center, and all of us at Brookings, we'd like to welcome you and especially welcome General James Amos, the Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, to be here today. We're delighted to have him. The format for today is that the General will speak for 10 or 15 minutes, summarizing some of his thoughts on some broad issues that I know are of interest to you as well. Then he and I will have a conversation here, and then we'll turn to the crowd. We have C-SPAN here covering and some other TV, so when and if I call on you in the course of that conversation, please be sure to identify yourselves, wait for a microphone before doing so, and then we'll proceed. General Amos is a combat aviator. He's from the great state of Idaho, where he attended college. He's been now in the Marine Corps for his entire 35-year or so career. He's the longest-serving service chief, so the senior member of that illustrious body, top advisor to the President on all matters national security, and, of course, the Marine Corps' top planner, budgeteer, combat conceptualizer, and so forth. He's had many jobs in this vein in his career at different levels of development, different levels of command, including, for example, in 2006 when he and General Dave Petraeus teamed up to write the counterinsurgency manual for the U.S. military. Prior to that, he had been instrumental in his combat aviator mode as a warfighter in the early stages of the invasion of Iraq. And prior to that, he had had a number of jobs deployed around the world, as all Marines do, and as we'll discuss further today, because I know one of the important priorities for General Amos is keeping the Marine Corps expeditionary, global, and responsive, which, of course, is a big part of the service's ethos, as the service is now well on its way towards withdrawing from Afghanistan, although still there with several thousand personnel as we speak. So without further ado, General, we're delighted to have you here. Everyone, please join me in welcoming the Commandant of the Marine Corps.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the kind remarks. And if I had only been in the Marine Corps for 35 years, I'd probably look a hell of a lot younger. But I've actually been it for 42 years. It's been my entire life. I just realized the other day my wife and I have been married 42 years, and we got married right after I joined the Marine Corps. And this is all we've ever known. It's, in some regards, it's kind of amazing. But thank you for the warm welcome. You know, I've got just a couple of bullets here. I'm not going to read any remarks, but I do have a couple of things I'd like to talk about here in opening. But, you know, I get asked often, what is it, what's the main thing that's on your mind that keeps you awake at night and that you spend time thinking about? And to be honest with you, it's how do you shepherd the Marine Corps through a period that we're in right now, this period of austerity? I mean, it is real. It is upon us. If you go back, and all of you in this room have done it, gone back and looked at the historical downturns after major combat, it sits around 32 to 33%. Sometimes it's 30, sometimes it's 29. But at last, that period from the peak to the kind of the bottom of the trough and where the trough begins to turn back up, that's a period of about somewhere around 9 to 10 years. And it's historical. And, I would hope that this time it's not the case. But you don't know. So as I look at and I try to prepare the Marine Corps for the future, I look at that historical downturn and I said, okay, how can we as a senior leadership of the Marine Corps and then myself as the Commandant shepherd, and I think that's the right term, shepherd the Corps through that period of austerity. And I'll be happy to answer questions on that here in a little bit. But I thought today, as I always do, is I want to remind everybody that as we gather in here, there are 30,000 Marines, give or take, probably 500 that are forward deployed around the world. They're on the Marine Expeditionary Units. Some are sitting in the Kearsarge out in the Gulf of Aden doing combat operations, doing our nation's national mission tasking. We've got Marines in the Gulf. We've got Marines flying in the Gulf. And, of course, we've got a significant contribution on the ground in Afghanistan. Switching around, turn the world on its axis. Going out to the Asia-Pacific area, we've got a large amount of Marines out there, both on aircraft carriers, on amphibious radio groups, training down in the Philippines, training in Singapore, training in Thailand. We have a Marine Rifle Company down in Australia is our nation's first installment for that renewed relationship or that reinvigorated relationship between the government of Australia, their army, and the United States Marine Corps. And so we're optimistic about that. But focusing more specifically on Afghanistan, because even though our nation has grown weary of war, I'm mindful, and I'd ask you to be mindful, of what's happening in Afghanistan. If you were to talk to John Allen when he was still the commander out there, and Joe Dunford would say exactly the same thing, if given the opportunity to complete the mission, not if given the opportunity to just to pull the last force out and leave, but to complete the mission, that both of those general officers, and I think they know more than probably any of us, will anticipate success. Now, success is defined by all of us in different ways. But let me focus narrowly on the Helmand province, which is where your Marines are today. About 7,200 of them. But it's just not us. There's about 8,000 UK forces there, and we've got two battalions of our Georgian brothers, the Republic of Georgia, not the state of Georgia. We've got Jordanians on the ground with us. We've got Australians on the ground with us. And we have a host of special forces and other allies. Bahrainis just left. They've been with us now for a long time, providing a great service. So in that Helmand province, which I would say arguably probably 5 years ago was certainly one of the more dangerous places in all of Afghanistan, and I go there frequently. I'll be there next month. Sergeant Major Barrett and I came back just recently. We spent Christmas there before that, and I've watched this progress to the point where I can tell you with some level of confidence that things are going particularly well. We have every reason to be confident that if given the opportunity, we'll be able to complete the mission and be successful in Afghanistan. Now, is it going to be maybe in your mind what success is defined as? Probably not. But in my mind, the way I define that is we will have given the people of the Helmand province, the provincial governor, the district governors, the chiefs of police, the Afghan National Security Forces writ large, the army police, and the central government of Afghanistan the greatest opportunity for success for the future. The conditions will have been set. It will be up to them to seize those conditions and proceed on. I feel very good about what's happening. We're done with, for the most part, offensive combat operations in Helmand province. We don't write operations orders now. We write supporting orders, and those supporting plans are in support of the Afghan National Army that are there. So we actually feel pretty good about how the Helmand province is going along. They've got a new provincial governor, and he's doing a terrific job. And we have a courageous corps commander down there that is built from one in his corps, from one brigade up to four now, and they're doing well. So I always want to represent those young men and women that are in Afghanistan. These are tough times we're in right now. It's not a trite statement. I want to remind everybody that I also am a taxpayer. I also pay taxes like many of you in this room. Hopefully all of you in this room are paying your taxes. But here we are in this unprecedented time where we've got the longest war our nation's been in. We have a fiscal crisis that's real, and it's upon us. We are drawing down forces in Afghanistan after 12, 13 years of combat between Iraq and Afghanistan. And then we're downsizing the force so that we can pay our bill while we face sequestration, which is a $500 billion bill over the next 10 years. I want to remind you that's on top of $487 billion, which had been passed a year and a half ago in the Budget Control Act. Don't lose sight of the fact that under Bob Gates, we found another $200 billion worth of bills that we had to pay with, and it was called efficiencies. I'll tell you, I don't recall the Marine Corps getting any of those $200 billion worth of efficiencies. So for the purposes of discussion, the bill is $1.2 trillion. Now, that's significant. I mean, it's real. It's real money, and it's going to have a real impact. So these are the times we're in right now. And let me just I'll give you my sense of what the world is likely going to look like over the next two decades. I see much of what we're going through right now. I don't see any of it waning away. I think the world over the next two decades, I don't see major theater war over the next two decades. I see the thorny, what I call difficult, challenging, human intensive, not necessarily technology intensive, but human intensive kind of conflicts and challenges over the next two decades. I often call them the nasty little things that happen around the world where, quite frankly, the international community, not just the United States of America, but the international community has responsibilities in around the world, global responsibilities. To what degree, yet to be seen. But my sense is that the world is not getting any nicer. I don't see any indication over the next two decades that things are going to settle down and things are going to become peaceful. Pick up the newspaper, any of your major newspapers, on a Sunday. In fact, you don't even have to wait till Sunday now. You can see it on your daily paper. Everything from what's happening in Syria, you see it on the nightly news and in the morning news. Take a look. We're not sure how that's going to play out. It's not clear yet precisely what's going to happen in Syria. And yet the whole world is focused on it. Well, what about the Hezbollah? I mean, there was stuff in the paper just this morning. Threats from the Syrian fighters who are threatening the Hezbollah. Okay, you better quit supporting the regime. So then you switch over to the Gulf. We're not quite sure. It's always challenging our relationship with Iran. I look at Iraq, quite honestly, and having lost 851 Marines killed in action in Iraq and over 8,440 Marines seriously wounded in Iraq. So we've got an investment. In addition to the monetary investment and the years and the sweat and toil, there's also our most precious commodity, which is the currency of that's our young men and women. So I have an investment in Iraq, and I actually pay very close attention to it. Yet to be seen how Iraq's going to play out. You watched it last night on the NBC, or excuse me, on the news last night, and you saw it again this morning. So there's no indication that that area is going to settle down. Turn the globe again on its axis. How about just a month and a half ago with the 30-year-old boy leader of North Korea? Well, you think about the rhetoric that was going on daily, I mean almost hourly. And I reminded everybody, because I'm probably there's a couple of you that may be older than I am, but I'm close to the oldest person in this room. And I distinctly remember Nikita Khrushchev in the 60s taking his shoe off and banging the heel at the United Nations. And the United Nations in New York City threatening thermonuclear war against the United States. We're going to wipe you out. And yet just a month and a half ago, and he now calls himself the Supreme Leader of North Korea, said that he will destroy the United States with thermonuclear war. I haven't heard rhetoric like that since the 60s. So, and that's just the highlight. There's territorial tensions. There's lots of things going on around the world. I was in the United Kingdom last week speaking to their command and staff college, their advanced schools, and talking with some of my French brothers about Mali and what's happening in Mali. Very courageous stance from my perspective on what the French have done, because sooner or later the international community is going to have to address some of these thorny, nasty, tacky little things that are going on around the world. We may think that we're done with them, but they are not necessarily done with us. So let me switch from that and talk a little bit about, okay, what do we do in this environment then? Now we've got this drawdown, this tension that's going on inside our nation, not just the Department of Defense. It's inside our nation. How are we going to pay our bills? How are we going to kind of reorient our focus back to the United States? But you can't ignore that world that I just described. You can't turn your back on it because actually it's very dangerous. In some cases, depending on what the threat is and where it is and who it's involved in, if the international community doesn't address some of these threats, then we may find those threats in Washington, D.C. We may find them in New York City. We may find them in the major cities all around the world. So somebody's got to do something. There has to be a sense of presence and a sense of engagement. And I'll be honest with you, very myopically and selfishly, and you're going to think it's self-serving. That's why you have a United States Marine Corps, and that's why you have a United States Navy. That's what we do. It's paid for. Yes, there's still bills that are out there. Yes, we're still building new pieces of equipment. But the fact of the matter is our naval vessels and our Marines and sailors are paid for. And this is what we do. We don't need a port. We don't need an airfield. We don't need to step on one of our allies' sovereign territory. Quite honestly, we sail around the world and we interact with nations and we build relationships, relationships that can't be surged in the time of conflict, actually relationships that are important to build trust right now. That's what we do. And then when things become just a little bit questionable, we can pull off a coast. And there's nothing quite that quite sends the same signal as three amphibious-ready ships full of 2,500 Marines. Not necessarily doing anything, but everybody understands the seriousness of what could take place. And in my experience, it has a calming effect. So there's an engagement responsibility our nation needs to acknowledge. So while we're drawing down and we want to come back to the United States and we want to reinvest in ourselves inside the Department of Defense, inside our nation, the balance then is, the question for me is, okay, what is that balance between the reality of the world and how you deal with it and how you live in that reality of the world, and then how you pay your bills, how you rebalance, how you reset your service. All the service chiefs are going through the challenges right now of resetting their forces, all of us, after 12, 13 years of combat. My service, probably more than any others. We took our equipment to war in Iraq, and for the most part, we left it there. And we continue to refurbish it there. We brought four maintenance facilities so we could actually refurbish it instead of putting it on ships and sending it home, and then turning around and having to send it back again. So most of the equipment that we had in Iraq actually found its way over to Afghanistan. And the equipment that's coming out of Afghanistan now has been in that part of the world for a long time. So the challenges I have right now as a service chief is the reality of the budget. Sequestration is real. Ladies and gentlemen, the bill was signed on March the 2nd. I take it as reality. I'm not in denial on sequestration. It is real. And we're working on a Marine Corps right now that will pay our bills, pay my portion of sequestration. Now, if Congress down the road elects to change this, the American people decide that, okay, we need a better way to do business than this sequestration, which, by the way, I think is a terrible way to do business. But it certainly has an effect. So if they change, then that's great. But for right now, I've worked on a plan, and we've been working on it now for about 90 days on how we'll pay our bills. And I know precisely how we'll do it. The key then is, okay, for us as a nation now, then how much is enough, and how much do we need to have forward deployed, because we've got global responsibilities. My last point I'd like to make is that we do have responsibilities as a superpower. Now, you could argue with me and say there are other superpowers out there, but actually, and this isn't a prideful statement, I think the United States is, if not the sole superpower, certainly the most significant superpower around the world. We do more things right than we do things wrong. We actually work pretty hard to try to provide peace and stability. Some of you may take issue with that and argue with that, but I think we do. So the issue is, what is our responsibility as a global nation? If you just turn to the Asia-Pacific area, we've got five major treaties in the Asia-Pacific area. Five. And they go back decades. Decades. We've got responsibilities. I'd argue that many of the nations in the Asia-Pacific area rely on the presence of the United States, rely on us as a stabilizing factor. We've got those responsibilities in other areas around the world, and I don't think we can ignore them. So as I began with how do I shepherd the Marine Corps through these periods of austerity, as I put my Joint Chiefs hat on, now I take my Commandant of the Marine Corps hat off, and I think about the nation and what's best for the nation. The balance then is, okay, how do we fulfill our role as a global superpower? And then we as a Department of Defense, what is our responsibility in that? And then more specifically and more tightly focused, what's my responsibility to provide capabilities as the Commandant of the Marine Corps for our 202,000 Marines that we have on active duty? And with that, I think I'll stop, and Mike and I will jump up here, and we'll take some questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, General. That was excellent. And I'd like to pick up with a couple of the themes that you usefully began with and really get right to the sequestration matter in a little bit more detail. And I'm going to begin sort of as a friendly skeptic might and raise the issue in terms of the debate we heard last year. Not so much from anything that I remember you saying, but certainly Secretary Panetta and others were basically saying, if sequestration is allowed to happen, the sky's going to fall. And now we're a couple months into it, and the sky doesn't seem to have fallen. I'm not trying to defend sequestration, by the way, just so you know, but I think a lot of people will wonder why such a hullabaloo was made of this. So much rhetoric was devoted to this, to trying to avoid it. It's happened, and now we seem to be doing okay, at least in the short term. And then the obvious follow-on question is, does that mean we can just keep it in place and keep the $500 billion in cuts over 10 years, as opposed to just suffering through sequestration for a few weeks or months? So why didn't the sky fall?
Yeah, it's because it hasn't taken root yet. I read this in the papers just like all of you do, and if that was the extent of the depth of your look into it, then I would say that's probably a great question. The fact of the matter is that the issues, when I said there were designing a Marine Corps to live within the constraints, my 10%. When that's unveiled, and by the way, all the services are doing it, when that's unveiled and revealed, which will happen when the president decides that he's satisfied with the planning that we've done, when that happens, that's when the sense of what sequestration will do and is all about will begin. That will be significant. And so the fact of the matter is we're in FY13. The Congress helped us out by giving us a budget in 13 and while everybody else was on continuing resolution. And the real significant impacts of sequestration are being planned for 14 and on out for the next really nine and a half years. So it's just it hasn't taken root yet, but it will. And it will here, I would predict, within the next 6 months.
Can you give us a sense, just to make sequestration in fiscal 13 a little more tangible for people, how are operations and how are training regimens changing? Right. Starting, I guess, about now, if I remember the planning sequence that people anticipated under sequestration, what are people not going to be doing this summer that they normally would be doing? And how worried about that are you just for this particular 3 months? In other words, can we sort of afford to do less for one summer as long as we don't continue that indefinitely at a lower state of readiness?
Yeah, Mike, we as an institution, and I specifically, made a decision that we would take monies out of other accounts for this year and move it to what we call readiness. And by that, what I mean is we've taken money out of facilities sustainment. So all the buildings in the barracks that our Marines live in, our training ranges, the offices, the places we work in and out of, that's one area where I reached in and touched. I also reached in and touched those units that are not necessarily in the queue to deploy next. I pulled money out of those units for training. And I've gone through and pulled money out of just about every account I can to maintain the readiness this year for those units that are obviously forward deployed. They're the highest priority. Those that are next to deploy. In other words, we have, as we approach the end of this summer in August and September, we'll begin to turn the force over in Afghanistan. We'll have units that are deploying into the Western Pacific. And those units will be at the highest state of readiness. So I've effectively mortgaged near-term readiness near-term sustainment and other monies to pay for that readiness. And I've told everybody I can do that for this year. But here's what the impact's going to be if nothing changes and we roll right into sequestration. And we roll, by the way, into a continuing resolution for next year. I mean, I don't think we should turn our back on that. I think that's the reality of what we're probably going to face for 14 is a continuing resolution. So when that happens, my readiness will drop. Right now, as I predict, as we go into the January timeframe, a little bit less than half of my combat units, my aviation squadron and my ground combat units, both my infantry and those units, the logistics battalions that support them, will be a little bit less than 50% combat ready. So half my forces will be less than ready to deploy to combat. I want to be clear, if something happens, we're going to go. I mean, if something bad happens around the world, we're going to go. We've always done that. But that's not the way we train, and that's not the way we like to deploy forces that are prepared. So it's impacting now. If things don't change, in my sense is I'm not optimistic that they will, then the readiness that we have mortgaged or the sustainment that we've mortgaged this year will roll in the next year and will become in compound interest.
Let me now focus a little bit, if you don't mind, on your major equipment modernization efforts and how they're faring these days. And I know that's got to be a big concern, too. But just to remind those who aren't always studying the Marine Corps in detail, but, of course, you've got the F-35B aircraft. You've got your amphibious vehicle that you'd like to replace. And you yourself made a decision, I think, a couple of years ago to cancel the previous version. You didn't think it was doing well, and you were a good custodian of the taxpayer's dollar in making sure that you dealt with that program as you felt it had to be. But you still have an unmet need for a replacement there. You've got the Osprey, which continues to be purchased, the tilt-rotor transport aircraft. You've got a few other major programs and a lot of smaller ones. How are all those programs faring, and how would you explain their fate under sequestration both now and into next year?
Well, as we looked at in this effort that I was telling you about, that we looked at over the next previous 60 to 90 days, we've taken the Osprey, which is now in its second multi-year contract, I probably, as well as anybody in this room, except for maybe Otto or some of the folks, probably remember well the Osprey struggling at the beginning of 2000. We're well beyond that right now. Now, the airplane is, the squadron's for the most part, probably about three-quarters fielded. The airplane is doing incredible, and I'd be happy to talk about that if somebody's interested in this exactly what it's doing. So that's going well, and we anticipate that we've got money in that pool, in that contract for the multi-year. So it's doing well. The amphibious combat vehicle, which is a replacement for the tractors that we currently have. We call them tractors. It's not a farm all. It's not a John Deere. It's actually an amphibious vehicle that comes out of the well deck of a ship and swims ashore loaded with combat Marines inside of it. It's our vehicles right now are a little over 40 years old. We've got about 1,250 of them. And we've refurbished those and done what we call a service life extension on them at least twice. So we have a program to replace those, and that's the amphibious combat vehicle. And by the time that vehicle is fielded, the ones we have are fully operational capable, so to speak. The ones we have will be over 50 years old. So we need it. You come off an amphibious ship only one of two ways. You fly off of it or you swim off of it in one of these vehicles. That's it. And but we've got some transport connectors like the LCAC, the air cushion vehicle, but that doesn't haul the Marines. So we need it. I'm working right now. I mean, we have been at it for 2.5 years since we canceled the FE to get that right. I'm only going to get one more shot at getting this right, so I take it very, very seriously. Industry has helped us out with this thing. We'll be making a decision this coming fall on what we're going to do on the amphibious combat vehicle with regards to speed and capabilities. But what I'm looking for right now is what I call just a good Ford F-150 kind of a vehicle that's reliable, beefy, and can move our Marines around. The last thing I'd like to make on that is please don't just think that this is a vision of a vehicle that is in an amphibious assault. When we had 7 amphibious ships and 5,000 Marines on Haiti about 4 years ago, helping them, it was our amphibious tractors that were going back and forth. We had them 450, 500 miles inside of Iraq, and you know that. So they're our utility fighting vehicle for us. The F-35B is our replacement. It's doing well. We've stood up our first squadron out on the West Coast in Yuma. We'll have 16 airplanes in that squadron by the end of the year. It is a It is the only short takeoff and vertical landing airplane being built in the world. It's the only one. The Harriers that we have right now run out of service life in the about the mid-20s. Some run out of service life before then. And you could ask yourself, well, why do we need something like that? Well, we've got 11 large deck amphibious ships. And so envision these as kind of carriers. So anywhere around the world, when you've got a large deck amphibious ship like the Kearsarge, which is in the Gulf of Aden today, performing national missions with Harriers, you now have a fixed-wing capability that can fly off that ship and go out and do the bidding of the nation. If you didn't have that, if we just let the Harrier die, then we'd have 11 large deck carriers that actually would just be helicopter platforms. And I think we're cutting ourselves short. Plus, it doesn't fit with our expeditionary model. So those programs are funded as we built the budget for the pay my bill, share of the bills. I've accounted for that and to keep those programs alive.
Thank you. And you said something very interesting, a number of things very interesting, but one in particular that caught my ear in your opening remarks. You said that you don't see major theater wars being all that likely in the next 20 years. And I know that I would probably agree with you in terms of the relative likelihood of big wars versus small wars. And I know you were making the point that we needed expeditionary capability for a lot of smaller things. But if you don't mind, I'd like to examine that first part of your sentence and ask, of the big wars that you don't think are very likely, which do you think we still have to be ready for? And I realize some may be too sensitive or too hypothetical to talk about in a public forum, but could you give an example or two of the kind of larger campaigns that, if any, that you think the country and the Marines need to be ready for?
I think, I'm glad you asked that because I want to make sure everybody understands that when I said that, I don't think, I don't anticipate that. The one thing I'd remind everybody is we've actually guessed wrong more often than we've guessed right in the past. So it's certainly not prophetic by any stretch of the imagination. But just looking at the, the proclivity of our nation now, having drawn out of 13 years of combat to reengage itself, is probably pretty slim. But I don't think for a second, as a member of the Joint Chiefs, that we should ever think that it is it will not happen. We've been fooled before. We came out of World War II thinking, boy, war to end all wars, World War I, and we're right back into it again. And then World War II, we really thought we were done with it, and right back in it again we were in 50-51. We have to be prepared for what we used to call major theater war. We have to be. Our nation has to be. There has to be enough capacity where when something happens that we can actually, and America, the American people expect that. They may be struggling with, okay, how much and what's it cost right now, but I guarantee you when it happens, the people of America and Congress are going to expect, and the president is going to rightfully expect that its military, all the services, are going to be prepared to go do that. So I don't think this becomes just an expeditionary force that handles these small, nasty little crises. We have to be prepared to be able to do major theater war. And I got to tell you, none of us in this room knew precisely what was going to happen with North Korea here a month and a half ago. And that was probably wasn't on anybody's radar in here. And all of a sudden, it just blossomed. And none of us knew exactly how that was going to turn out. So, I mean, there's an example of should our nation ever need to, there's an example where our nation would have to have the capacity, the capability and the capacity to be able to respond.
So let me try to, I'm going to begin to wrap up here in a second, but I want to try to tie together some of these different pieces. We've talked about sequestration, we talked about modernization, we talked about major theater war and smaller operations. Can you help us understand at what point the budget cuts really make you, in a whole new way, fundamentally uncomfortable? I mean, obviously, you're coping with sequestration in the short term. You've already explained to us why it's probably worse than it looks, and you found some ways to compensate in the short term. But in terms of longer-term force planning, at what point do budget cuts really become crippling to our ability to handle the major theater wars plus the smaller stuff. How do you explain this to a skeptical audience? Because even if sequestration occurs, we're still going to have a defense budget that's $500 billion a year. That's going to be above the Cold War average in real dollars. And people are going to say, some people are going to say, well, why can't you get by with that? What's the real risk? You're doing a little less here and a little less there, but it still looks like a pretty good military. Is there any way you can link a certain size budget cut to a real fundamental threshold at below which we just don't want to go?
Yeah, I don't have a monetary figure for the Department of Defense. I know that within my own service, as we look through, okay, how do we pay the sequestration bill? And then what does that force structure look like? And you and I had an opportunity to talk about this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. But so we know what that would look like roughly in people and in equipment, capabilities, and capacity. So we have a sense for that. There is a dollar figure in my service. But I'll tell you that where I worry is that this force that I'm looking at building for to accommodate sequestration, you know, my 10%, is going to here's some attributes of that force, which I think are significant. Back to the major theater war, which we talked about, which we have a, you know, I have an obligation to do my part and be prepared for the American people and the president. If that happens, the force that we're building will go to war, and it will come home when the war is over. Now, that's not something that we're used to. My father was used to that. My wife's father was used to that. They went off to the war in the Pacific, and 4 years later, the bus pulled up in front of the red dirt road in Alabama, and my father-in-law got off. Same thing with my dad. We're used to rotating forces every 7 months in the Marine Corps. So we'll rotate a battalion, or we'll rotate a squadron, or we'll rotate a combat logistics battalion. We'll rotate major headquarters every 13 months. That's not what's going to happen. So that's the first thing that's a threshold. The second thing is the force that we're building under sequestration is on what we call a 1-2 dwell. That's significant. So that's different. And what I mean by a 1-2 dwell is that the force goes away for 6 months. It deploys. It goes on a ship. It does theater security cooperation. It goes on an aircraft carrier. It goes into the Pacific, the Asia-Pacific area. It's gone for 6 months. It's home for 12 months. And then it goes again. Just to kind of give you a sense of, well, what does that mean? During the height of Iraq, most of the ground forces were on at least a 1-to-1, was probably about as best as it could get. So you were gone 7 months and you were home 7 months, and you were gone 7 months and home 7 months. That begins to wear on the force, because when you're home that 7 months, you're really not home that 7 months. You're 30 days out in the desert training in preparation. You've got schools you've got to go to. So you're really home at your home for 5 months. We talked 5-6 years ago when I was out at Quantico and testifying in front of the House and the Senate that we were coming out of the war, we would build a force that was on a 1-to-3 or a 1-to-4 deployment to dwell ratio. So if it was a 1-to-3 deployment to dwell, you'd go for 6 months and you'd be home for 18 months, and then you'd go for 6 months and home for 18 months. So the force that we're building in the United States Marine Corps to pay our bills is going to be a 1-to-2. And now the fact is the Marines will probably like that, just because Marines were a young force and we like to deploy. But our families probably aren't going to be too thrilled about it. And there's a little bit of danger in that, because the issues that begin to kind of come back in the home front. So it will be a go to war and stay, and when the war's over, come home force. And it will be a force that will be rapidly turning around force. So that's what we're building under sequestration.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I've got a few more questions I could ask, but I'm going to hold myself in check and turn to you and maybe throw one in later. So please, we'll start with Peter Singer. Microphone here in the front row. Please identify yourselves and ask the general question.
Peter Singer with Brookings. Thank you again for joining us. We've had a talk that's been interesting. Mike's been asking you in many ways about the future, and you answered both about the future but then gave certain historic echoes, you know, the experience of dwell time and the like. I'm interested in pulling that a little bit further. In the Marine Corps' history, is there a parallel that you think about in terms of organizational challenges, organizational identity, that you keep in mind as you're dealing with these questions for the future? What are some of the lessons that you learn? Is it from patterns from the 1990s? Is it the 1920s? Is it the 1890s? Yeah. What are the lessons that you think about in terms of Marine Corps history?
Yeah, Peter, I've read the writings of a lot of the previous commandants. We've got seven of them besides myself that are still alive today, and I read most of what they've written. A couple of them went through some very challenging times. General Carl Mundy went through some pretty challenging times trying to sort out, okay, what was the force structure going to look like? There was a period of time when, as I recall, he was the trend was to take the Marine Corps down to 160,000. And General Mundy ended up with a force of about 172,000, 173,000. So some have been faced with the real challenging budgetary issues. But I don't think anything like we're going through today. I really do think that these are unprecedented. Maybe the 36th and 37th Commandant will say the same thing. But if you go back to 1946. And it still astounds me that we as a nation just completely emasculated at the entire Department of Defense. I mean, we just after that war, I realized we were tired of it, but we fought war on two continents. And with our allies, we were successful. Had that not turned out that way, we probably wouldn't be sitting in this room. Things would have turned out dramatically different. But we as a nation took the services and went completely into the basement. So I look at that and I think about how quickly that turned around. The debate in 1948, 1949 within Congress, within President Truman, Secretary of War, even some of the great general officers at that time. The debate that took place, and all of a sudden, 1950, we were ill-prepared. And I would argue that when we went to war in Korea, our lack of preparedness and readiness probably cost us dearly in the early phases of the war. I think any of us that are historians read that, and you can't, it's inescapable. We finally caught up and figured it out, but it was costly to get there. Marine Corps hasn't been, for anecdotal purposes, hasn't been below 171,000 since 1951. The Marine Corps has not. So no administration, no leadership and Congress has taken the Marine Corps below 171. Probably a reason for that. I don't know that I would just say that's the reason, but I think there's plenty of other. But I look at the challenging times and I go, probably the post World War II is the one I look at, Peter, and I go, okay, we got to get this right. Again, for all of us in here, we have different opinions about how much is enough and what's right and how much in this service and how much in that. And I do understand that. We're not going to get it exactly right. But what we can't afford to do as a nation is get it exactly wrong. And so, I look at coming out of World War II, and I would just ask everybody, just, okay, everybody take a deep breath. We'll work our way through the budget. We'll work our way through the force sizing efforts over the next probably 6 months to a year. But let's not lose or forget about the lessons from that period of time.
Next question, over here in the third row, please.
Thank you, General, for your comments. Megan Catt with CNA. My question is more along the training and education line. Over the last decade, cultural, language, and regional skills have really been emphasized in training and education. Now that the force is looking forward, and especially with sequestration cuts and other budget cuts, how important do you see those skill sets for potential missions moving forward, especially as you're trying to rebalance training and education efforts?
I think, thank you for the question. I think It's every bit as important in the next two decades based on that environment that I described, where it is people-intensive kinds of engagement. Sometimes it's training and engagement. Sometimes it's actual conflict of various sizes. But I think the lessons that we've learned over the last 10, 12 years of war are critical to the future. I mean, it's language, it's culture. You know, we started using a term about a year and a half ago, human terrain. Before that, we used to talk about war among the people. Well, it's not all war. It's a lot of relationship building. It's a lot of confidence building. But it's the among the people is the most important part. We can't afford to lose that. And we will not lose that in the Marine Corps. In fact, our schools are our resident schools for our officers and non-commissioned officers. And I made it very clear that as we go forward, we're not going to lose the lessons of kind of the counterinsurgency mindset. We did after Vietnam, and we forgot all about it. And it took a while to relearn them. I'd argue right now that we probably, all of us, probably the principal ground forces and special operations forces are probably doing that better than we've ever done it before. But we don't want to lose that because there are plenty of places around the world where it might be a small insurgency. I'd argue that what's happening in Mali is an insurgency. It could be a very lethal one. And so how do you deal with that? So that's a classic case of trying to deal with something among the people of Mali. You know, there are folks that want to eke out a living. So if we're going to be, as an international community, touching those kinds of communities, then we've got to be mindful of their culture, their languages, their nuances, the things that are important in those. That's why, quite honestly, relationship building is critically important to me. I mean, I think, you know, as I talk to my my officers, and every year we select a new team of brigadier generals, and I spend a lot of time with them, and I talk to them about the importance of relationships. Because as you go ashore, and you pick some country, maybe we have the benefit of having been there before, perhaps we've never even been able to pronounce the name of it. The relationships that are built there will be the thing that will cause us to either be successful, helpful, or not. But we are not going to turn our back on that. Okay. And we, by the way, just so you know, we've doubled the amount of forward area officers and doubled the amount of regional area officers to include our staff NCOs. We never used to include our staff non-commissioned officers in that. So we're sending them to the Monterey right now to get a postgraduate education and then go to the Defense Language Institute. So these are gunnery sergeants and staff sergeants and master sergeants because they can do it.
Otto here in the fourth row, and then we'll come up to the second row after that.
Thank you. General Otto Kreiser, Sea Power and Semper Fi magazines. You've got you're downsizing, and at the same time, Congress and the administration wants you to beef up your embassy security detachments. Yeah. You've sent one unit, you know, to Europe already, and you're creating a couple others. How are you going to manage that, you know, one, the manpower and the budget crunch of downsizing to 182, if they'll let you stop there, while still trying to add another 1,000-plus to the embassy security job, and what all are you doing in that vein?
Thanks, Otto. When the questions first began, which was probably 8 or 9 months ago, about okay, how many embassies are the Marines at, and we're about half of them around the world, and we're somewhere around 160. Embassies and consulates around the world, and there are about twice as many. So there's another half that there's no Marines resident at. And so when we were asked, what could you do? The answer was, well, we can't do any more with what we have, so we'll need to put more Marines into this if that's the will of Congress. And well, how many more do you think you'd need? And we did some work fairly quickly, and the number roughly was about 1,000 Marines. And so Congress faithfully went after that, and that was included in the NDAA language, as you're well aware, and it's 1,001 Marines to add. In the discussions while we were talking about that, we talked about missions of those units. A Marine Security Guard detachment at an American embassy is roughly about one senior staff NCO and five or six young Marines that are corporals and lance corporals. And they're highly trained. They have skill sets that that other Marines don't necessarily have. And they have security clearances that are critical to their jobs. Their job is to not only to protect the chancery and protect the immediate consul or embassy, but to secure the classified material that's in there. Their job is not really to get in a vehicle and provide a protective service as the ambassador or somebody else travels around whatever nation they're in. That's not their mission. So if you were going to plus this up, how will we do this thing? And so we developed some training standards and plan. I asked in the discussions with Congress, I said, look, can you do this, General Amos? The answer is yes. Would you like to do this? The answer is yes. I think we do it. It's part of our who we are. But how do you pay for them? The original intent in the discussions was that they would be above my force structure line. In other words, whatever 182,100 Marines, these would be on top of that, and they would be paid for by a line item out of Congress. And that was the original discussion. I don't know that it's going to turn out that way. I want to be clear that this is a mission that I think is important to our nation, and that I think the Marine Corps ought to do it. So in dealing with my service, I've looked at everybody and I said, you know, regardless of how this turns out with regards to money, we're going to do this mission. So, Otto, it'll either be on top of 182.1 or it'll be 192.1. Excuse me, 180.1. 181.1. That's math in front of the public. It's not good. 181.1. Okay, so yet to be seen. But it's a mission that's important. We're going to do it. We're working with the State Department right now. We've got, as I recall, there's six embassies that will receive a Marine Security Guard detachment here in the next little bit, and probably another half a dozen or so before the end of this year. And we'll slowly build that capacity up. But we got to work with, you know, it's a deal between us and the State Department. And because when you put Marines there, you've got to have a place for them to live, and it's got to, you know, there's got to be security around the area. But what we did, which is really important, we built a small force that can be rapidly flown in to reinforce a Marine Security Guard detachment, and that's called a security augmentation unit. And those forces, we can put them on a C-130, we can put them on MV-22s, and we can fly them anywhere in the world. If there's indications and warnings that this is probably not an area is an area that's going to have issues, we can put the Marines in there ahead of time. So we have that. Okay.
Let's go up here, second row, please.
Colin Clark, Breaking Defense. Good morning, sir. I'm betting that your IOC date for the F-35 is going to be 14. You don't have to tell us unless you want to. Given that, you've got to start developing some CONOPs. I'm wondering, as you look at the Kirsigarg and some of the other lessons you've learned over the past 2 years, how you see the 35 working with the 22 and how it's going to change how you work in the Pacific in particular.
Yeah. This may be the first time we say this publicly, but our IOC is likely going to be in 2015. Not 2014. And the definition of initial operational capability are 10 airplanes, 10 crews, full maintenance suite that is all trained, the maintainers are all trained up on it. They've been trained, both the pilots and the air crews, to do the missions of the airplane, and they're shipboard qualified. So that's the definition of IOC. The squadron itself will be a full 16 airplanes. So it'll have more than the 10. But that right now we're planning on that happening towards the latter part of 2015. But back to the lessons learned, the concept of operations and employment. I think if you take a look at that, how the amphibious ships of late have been used, and then I'm going to take you back to 2003 on, because I actually have a little bit of experience in this. So, but let's just talk about of late how they've been used, the V-STOL aircraft. When we were under, this is under the Secretary Gates era, when our carriers were pressed into the Gulf and doing the business of our nation in that part of the world, we still had other issues down in the Gulf of Aden. And we needed fixed-wing aircraft with precision weapons where you could do precise targeting. And the fact of the matter is the Harrier came into, it had already been into its being, but boy, that flying off those amphibious ships really became almost surgically, surgical capability for the President and the Secretary of Defense. So since that time, it has been used an awful lot in that regard. We've also had the squadrons on the ground, and we have a squadron on the ground right now of our Harriers in Helmet at Bastion Airfield. And you remember the terrible attack we had, last September, and we lost 6 airplanes out of that. But they've been flying close air support and in support of the coalition forces for some time. So there's that. If you turn the clock back just a little bit, when we weren't sure what was going to happen with Muammar Gaddafi, and the whole world, NATO and the United States, were trying to, okay, what is it we should do? You might find it interesting to note that they sailed the Kearsarge, 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit, and the Ponce up from the Gulf of Aden, Red Sea, Suez Canal, and they turned left and went off the coast of Libya, and they sat there. So while we were all trying to figure out, okay, what, or the President was trying to, okay, what are we going to do? No-fly zone, NATO, how are we going to do this? They actually were off the coast. During the first 2 days of the air war, or the no-fly zone reinforcement, they were the only airplanes that were actually flying, because we needed to get the tankers down from Europe and so we could tank the NATO aircraft. So there's a great example of the flexibility those airplanes did. But if you go back to OIF-1, the Iraq War, and I was the wing commander, and we had 72 Harriers, as I recall. And we were flying them off 2 large-deck amphibious ships, and then we moved them ashore. I've got pictures of them on Highway 1, just south of Karbala, landing out there right after I had just met up with then-Colonel Joe Dunford, who was the commanding officer of 5th Marine Regiment, and I landed in a helicopter out along the highway. It looked like I-95. And I said, "What do you need?" And he says, I need air support. So we started bringing in fuel, landed C-130s on the highway, landed our regular rotary wing, which is easy. And then we started landing Harriers there on the highway. I got pictures of it. And we rearmed them and refueled them and flew support for the eventual attack on Baghdad. So those are expeditionary methods that we will use our STOVL aircraft, and I expect we'll do exactly the same thing for the F-35B.
I'm going to throw in one question there before we go back to you. And I want to pick up on this very point you've made, General, but I don't want to get you in trouble with your fellow chiefs, but you made a pretty powerful argument for the value of short takeoff vertical landing aircraft, but you're the only service buying such things. Is that a mistake? Should the Air Force be buying some STOVL aircraft, especially in an era when airfields are becoming potentially so much more vulnerable to precision strike?
Well, you know, I'm not going to answer that question that way. If you take a look at, first of all, it's interesting, the UK, about a year and a half ago, the first Sea Lord, Sir David Richards, their Chod, approached me and said, okay, if we decided we'd come back in the STOVL, are you going to be okay with that? And, of course, the answer was yes, and we are to this day. We're training with them. In fact, we're putting UK pilots back into our Harrier squadrons. I got 8 Harrier squadrons right now. We're going to put a UK pilot and both either RAF or Navy pilot in each one of those squadrons. And they're going to continue. We got them training right now down at Eglin Air Force Base with the F-35B. So they're in it. Italy's in it. If you take a look at a picture of the world as a satellite flies over the world, and you see, take a look at where you image where all the 8,000-foot runways are and versus the 3,000-foot and less. And that's just runways. That's not highways or it's not parking lots or something like that. There are about 10,000 times as many 3,000-foot runways as there are 8,000-foot. For us, the places that we'll probably be operating, that's actually pretty important. So whether the Air Force should buy them or not, Michael, I won't touch that. But it's important for us because we're an expeditionary force. We're designed to go places where, quite honestly, other people either can't or they don't have the sustainment, the logistics. That's what we do. We're more than willing to live hard. We don't need fancy air-conditioned tin cans like you and I stayed in Afghanistan. We don't need a chow hall where you can get eggs to order every morning. That's bad for your health. And so we actually can live off our MREs. We also need to be able to operate our equipment off there. And I've got hundreds and hundreds of pictures of refueling airplanes and vehicles and arming them off of highways on the way to Baghdad.
Thank you. Next question. We'll start in the back. Gentleman in the blue striped tie
General, I also don't want to try to get you in trouble. I'm John Wertman with the Association of American Geographers, but I'm reading former Secretary Harold Brown's book right now that's actually a Brookings book, really interesting book. He talks about from the time he served as secretary to the present 35-year period, we now have something like 4 additional undersecretaries, 12 additional assistant secretaries in the Defense Department, and he made a strong argument for getting rid of the service secretaries. So without really trying to get you into trouble, in this era of sequestration, can you talk about sort of the bloat in the Pentagon leadership?
You guys really are trying to get me in trouble here. It's recognized that there's been growth within the Pentagon, both on the joint staff, the combatant commanders, and kind of what we call the fourth estate. You know, the folks that support the actual services. And that's one of the things that's going to have to be addressed under sequestration. In other words, the growth. What it turns out to be with regards to service secretaries, I kind of like my service secretary, and I kind of like what he does for the United States Marine Corps. He's one of our greatest advocates, former naval officer himself, and he understands us. So I'm actually very, very happy with where we are. But if you expand, which is really, I think, what your question really begs an answer to, is how much is enough with everything else? Because what happens is staffs grow, then the questions and the activities grow, and then the services have to respond because we have to. And so we grow. Our service headquarters grow in response to the growth of the forces that are the headquarters that are above us. It's a natural tendency. So I'll tell you, the question we're facing right now is, how much is enough? And we get into this thing called tooth and tail. Tooth being whatever that warfighting capacity, it could be cyber, it could be airplanes, it could be ships, it could be Marines, whatever that tooth is, then how much tail should be affiliated? There has to be some kind of what we call a tail, and that's headquarters and that's staff and that's people to kind of help out. But as we look at the Department of Defense and we look at the combatant commanders, and we actually even look inside of my own headquarters, there's tail there that under sequestration is going to have to go under the magnifying glass, and it's going to have to be scrutinized. Because what we can't have, we can't just continue to allow growth to happen at the expense of the warfighting capability of the United States of America. We have a Department of Defense for one reason and one reason only,
And it's not to do paperwork and answer questions. It's actually, we have it to defend the United States of America and defend its interest. That's why we have it. We don't have it for a whole lot of other things. So we just have to go back to that. And I'll tell you, as we work our way through sequestration and the impacts, that fourth estate and headquarters inside of my institution, without telling you what we've looked at, as I said, we've already built a plan to pay our bills. I'm whittling headquarters inside my own organization. But, you know, I haven't just looked outside. I've looked inside as well.
Stay in that same row. Right, next.
Thank you very much, General. I'm Jeffrey Lin from Senator Angus Kane's staff, and I hope my question will be less controversial, or at least less potential for it. So I'm wondering that, given you mentioned how the post-World War II drawdown in 1946 and subsequently how we had to suddenly build everything back up for Korea, does the DOD, especially the Marine Corps, have a plan for sort of being able to suddenly draw up, again, if we get another strategic surprise, Dr. O'Hanlon raised the possibility of earlier, and and how would such plans be affected by sequestration, for example?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, thank you. When Secretary Panetta, probably about 6 months, a year before he gave up his job, and we started looking, this was when the Budget Control Act was signed, and then, of course, sequestration was now a matter of, it was out there, and it was out there a year later, you know. And he said, look, as we do this, as we begin to reshape the force, he said, there's several things we've got to keep in mind. He says, well, we have to build an agile force. We have to build a flexible force. We have to build a force that actually takes care of the business that we're typically find ourselves involved in today, which I think is that kind of nasty, thorny stuff that I talked about at the beginning. And then he says, as you reshape the force, and this is to all the services, you have to build in reversibility. And then he also said, I don't want you to build a hollow force, which is probably worthy of talking of. And I could take you to 1990, and we don't have to go back too far and talk about hollowness. But he said reversibility is a key factor. So what does that mean? Well, if you're Admiral Greenard, you know, my shipmate, John Greenard's worried about the industrial base. I mean, we're down to, and if he was in here, he'd tell you precisely how many shipyards we have, but we don't have a lot of them anymore. And the ones we have are pretty important to the nation. We don't have a lot of aircraft manufacturers anymore. So those are pretty important to our nation. But regardless, you have to, as you draw the force down and you reshape the force, this matter of reversibility as it relates to industrial base, the reversibility to be able to, what I call blow the balloon back up. There are some things, if you decide, and I'll just say this, this F-35B matter. If something were to happen and we said, okay, that's it, we're not going to do that, that's an irreversible decision. Because nobody in the world is building a short takeoff and vertical landing fighter. Nobody is. Not another nation. You know, we built them, the U.K. did, we built them with Boeing and consorted with them. The Soviets built them, I think it was called the Yak-28. When I was Captain Amos, but nobody else. So there's a decision that becomes irreversible. There are some units that we could blow the balloon back up in a reversing motion or effort. Maybe an infantry battalion might be one. You could probably rebuild an infantry battalion. It would take you a couple of years, but we actually have experience in doing that. So reversibility for me is, and I think it's in line with what Secretary Panetta had, and I think it's exactly in line with what Secretary Hagel is thinking, is actually a critical, important part as we approach sequestration. So sequestration is going to affect that. And so as we make decisions, you know, as I go inside my force and we take a look at how I pay my bills, the one of the bumper stickers or one of the things on the wall is the term reversibility. So while we're making decisions on programs and people and equipment and capabilities, and capacity. We need to always remember, we may guess this wrong. We may have to turn this back around. And so if I'm going to take a capability away, it needs to be a purposeful decision, and I need to say to myself, okay, I'll never have to get that capability back again. Okay?
Next question. Stay in the back for a minute. The woman about three in, second to last row. Thanks.
Hi, thank you. Mackenzie Cooper from the Government Accountability Office. Could you address the status of the AOA for the ACB, particularly given my understanding that water speed requirements have not yet been addressed and won't be until the fall?
Can I ask you to re-ask your question one more time, taking out the acronyms, too, just for the general benefit of
sure.
the listening audience?
Government Accountability Office, I don't know if that's a GAO, sorry. And if you could address the analysis of alternatives and the status of it for the amphibious combat vehicle, given that my understanding is water speed requirements won't be addressed until the analysis won't be complete until the fall.
Okay, I'll tell you right where we are. The Office of Secretary of Defense and Congress directed that we do an analysis of alternatives last year. That was completed. It was held at OSD, Secretary of Defense's level, and on his staff. We were an active part of it. The Department of the Navy was an active part of it. And that completed in June of last year and reported out sometime probably around the July timeframe. And what it did is it confirmed the requirement for an amphibious vehicle, a tractor, as I described earlier, some type of surface-borne capability that you could use both in a combat environment for a forcible entry kind of thing if you ever had to do that again. And certainly it became, the follow-on. It's not an expeditionary fighting vehicle. It is a replacement for our current tractor, but it is a fighting vehicle. So it confirmed that. We took a look at that, and we said, okay, it didn't say anything about high speed or slow speed. And for the difference for everybody in here, when you have a vehicle like that and it's under development, the old expeditionary fighting vehicle actually had the capability to get up on planes. Imagine a water skier getting up on plane. And once you got up on plane, then you could go significantly faster. And as I recall, the expeditionary fighting vehicle, the EFE, was somewhere around 28 knots. Well, that gave you an awful lot of capability to be able to leave a ship and then go someplace where the enemy's not. The current vehicle we have is what we call a displacement vehicle. And that's a vehicle that goes about, the one we have doesn't go 8 knots, but it becomes a vehicle that stays, it swims. I mean, it's not below the surface, but it's like a boat that doesn't get up on a plane. And you get into physics here, and you literally cannot push a heavy vehicle through the water any faster than of that size, any faster than about 8 knots. So what I asked was, okay, let's go back. As I said earlier, we're only going to get one more bite at this apple. We want to do it right. Let's go back and just make sure that we understand the difference between the value between a high water speed and a displacement vehicle. So the analysis of alternative is done. What we're doing right now, we're working with industry. We've actually got two corporate partners that have teamed together, and they will report to the Marine Corps in this fall, and they'll tell us what the art of the possible is with regards to high water speed versus regular displacement vehicle. And then what the cost is. And I made it clear to everybody, cost is a variable in this. I mean, we canceled the EFE because of cost and because of a host of other things. But I'm not about to go do it again. And so we want to get it right. And I'm confident that by the time we hit the fall, I'll have enough information to be able to actually make an educated recommendation to the Secretary of the Navy as to how to proceed. My sense is we'll make a decision in the fall, and then probably around the beginning of next year release what we call an RFP, request for proposal, on okay, who's going to, and we'll have money available to do that. So that's where we're headed. We've got a modest amount of money in the five-year future-year defense plan for research and development, and that's really what. We don't have any procurement dollars in there. It's just research and development.
Come back here to the third row. Gentleman in the orange tie, please.
Good morning, General. Dan Lamoth with Marine Corps Times. I wanted to ask you about your special operators. You've been a huge proponent of MARSOC over the last few years. Yeah. They're, like many other parts of the Marine Corps, moving in transition, moving with more of a maritime feel. What do you see their missions and roles being in out years, and how will that affect the reconnaissance and force reconnaissance communities?
Yeah, thanks. I'm pretty proud of, in fact, I'm very proud of Marine Special Operations Command. Stood it up. It's in its sixth year now, and it sits about 2,600 strong. It's based out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, headquartered there, and then we've got battalions there, and we've got one out at Camp Pendleton. And they're an integral part of Admiral McRaven's Special Operations Command. He owns them. We provide the Marines. We provide not all the equipment, but we provide the standard equipment, and we provide the salaries and all that stuff. So they have done very, very well. And if Admiral McRaven were here, he would confirm that. So their future is bright in that kind of decade, the kind of decades that I described. I mean, that's why I started with what I thought the world would look like over the next two decades, because if you believe that, then there's plenty of work available for Special Operations Force, and we're a partner in it. I've got no intention of downsizing Special Operations because I think the value added for our nation, I think it's one of those things that's good for our nation. We're working right now on a concept, and we will prototype it this fall with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit off the West Coast on training with Special Operations Forces, again with the ARGMUs, the MUs, Marine Expeditionary Units that will go to sea on those three amphibious ships. There was a period of time in the 90s, and really at the very beginning of the turn of this century, where every aircraft carrier had... It wasn't a SEAL team, but it would be a group of SEALs that would be aborted. Every ARGMU, every amphibious radio group, Marine Expeditionary, had a team of SEALs on board. And in about 2001, that changed, and it became a function of, well, there are other things, and then the war in Iraq broke out, and they became preoccupied. They've not been back aboard naval vessels, except for unique specific surgical type operations on any kind of routine basis since then. So we spent a couple of weeks doing some war gaming here last month, and we've agreed to a concept. We're going to try it out this coming fall with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, and where we'll have Marine Special Operations Forces that will have trained up with the MU as it goes out. And we'll also put Marine Special Operations teams, liaisons in the what they call the Theater Combatant Command, the Theater Special Operations Command. And so we'll have a habitual relationship. We'll know exactly what's available as we move in and out of theaters. We'll have some special operators on board the ship, and they will be our eyes and ears and our liaison. They're the ones that are going to work, and they know our capabilities, and we'll know theirs, and they'll know the capabilities of the special operators in theater. And we think this is a pretty good installment now to provide relevance for the theater combatant commanders. So that's where we're headed. I think the relationship, the fact that we are reemphasizing our amphibious roots, actually nest pretty well with special operations. So we're going to have to wait and see. My expectations actually are very positive on this thing.
We've got time for about two more questions, and I'm going to ask one of them, and then I'll come to you. And I wanted to get at the issue of how you're thinking about China, but I'm going to do it in a specific way. And obviously with the coming summit between the presidents of China and the United States and all the concerns about China's growing military capabilities and ongoing tensions in the East and South China Seas, there's a lot to talk about. But I actually want to get at this through more of a force planning and budgeting
dimension, more in line with your direct responsibilities, through the concept of air-sea battle. And air-sea battle, of course, for those of you who don't know as much about it, it's primarily an Air Force and a Navy idea. It's not really a formal doctrine, but it's gained a lot of attention, and it's seen as a response in some ways to the growing prevalence of precision strike weapons. And people try hard to say it's not about China specifically, but obviously China has the resources to buy a lot of these precision strike weapons more than most. So I guess, you know, some of the I support and admire a lot of the concepts behind air-sea battle as an idea, but just two specific questions. One is, are the other services and the allies now becoming part of this concept? Because initially it was primarily an Air Force and Navy, you know, thought. And, of course, you're part of the Department of the Navy, but you're a separate service. I wanted to ask you what role the Marine Corps, if any, is playing in air-sea battle. Is it something that inspires you? Is it something you look to for guidance? Is it a debate you're contributing to? Or was it a sort of a one-time Air Force-Navy, you know, thought that's sort of had its heyday and is now fading a little? But then the second part of the question, do you think the name needs to be reconsidered, if nothing else, because it harkens back to air-land battle, which was our way of dealing with the Soviet threat to Europe. It's a fairly confrontational sounding, you know, it's a catchy but confrontational sounding slogan that China in particular seems to take a little bit of, you know, a bad reaction to. And so could you comment just on how you're thinking about air-sea battle these days?
Yeah, I think I hadn't thought about changing the name, but you're probably right. Without having put any thought to that, it's probably like a lot of things when they when they're first conceptualized. You look back and go, "There's probably a better way we could have marketed it." So I would. What would be a new name? I don't know. But to your point about the concept, and it is. It's a concept. I kind of look at it as a phase of an operation. And I think that's the safest way to look at it and put it in context of whatever the overall operation is going to be. And by that I mean it's an anti-access aerial denial. I mean, how do you deal in an environment where people don't want you to come in? And by the way, that's not new. Now, the technology has become more advanced to push the force offshore. Or push them back in the air, but the actual aerial denial thing has been, you know, it's historical. I mean, it goes way back. So I look at it as a phase. If we have an operation where we are actually trying to impose our will somewhere on the world, the enemy is going to try his best to ensure that we don't. And it's going to be, he's going to do that through a variety of means, one of which could be kinetic weapons. It could be air-breathing weapons. It could be weapons that go exo-atmosphere weapons that come back down. It can be cyber. I'd argue that cyber can be is an area where you could be denied. I mean, the impact of cyber could prevent a force from certainly accomplishing its mission and being able to have access. But as we kind of think about terrain and we think about, okay, coming ashore in an opposed environment, I think all the services are playing in it, Mike, and not playing it. I think we take it very, very seriously. It is a phase. When you're going against a determined enemy, the last thing you want to do is go where the enemy expects you to go. You know, when you start thinking about broad coastlines and extended ranges, what you want to do is put the enemy on the horns of a dilemma. So it's not just bullet versus bullet or missile versus missile. You could do that, and there's a part of it that fits that. But it actually, since most determined enemies can't defend on every frontier, what you want to do is you want to have forces that are capable to challenge the enemy on a very wide front. And that's really where amphibious forces come in. And that's where Stovall F-35 comes in. I mean, you know, there are a lot of places, not only on ships, that you could actually land them ashore around the world and without being on a runway somewhere.
you can land amphibious forces, the mere threat of forces maneuvering in, on your flank, depending on where you are, what country it is that's trying to prevent you, it drains off assets. So it's an anti-access aerial denial strategy. And it's one that we all participate in, all the services do. And I don't think it's mature yet. I think it will get there. Everybody seems to worry about it. It's a bunch of programs. It could be programs. There probably are people that think it's these 150 programs. It's actually more than that. It's not a concept of operations. It's nested in a concept of operations. How we go against an enemy that's trying to prevent us from coming ashore. So that's how I see it. It's nested in there. We're all in it together. Services are very cooperative with it. So it's more than just some number of programs that are very, very costly. It needs to be a part of how we conceptualize the concept of operation.
And last question over here, a gentleman in the tan jacket against the wall.
So good morning. My name is Paul Tennant. I'm a British Army officer actually working on exchange in the Pentagon. I was interested in an earlier response to a question about major theaters of war and specifically the lack of a mention of the Army's role. I'd be very interested in your vision over the next 20 years of, in broad terms, the boundaries and overlaps between the roles you envisage for the U.S. Marine Corps and the roles you would envisage for the U.S. Army.
Yeah. Just so I make sure I've got this correctly, it's over the next couple of decades, how I see the coalition boundaries between the U.S. Marine Corps and our coalition partners? What exactly do you mean?
Specifically, how you see the roles and responsibilities of the U.S. Marine Corps mapping with the equivalent roles and responsibilities of the U.S. Army. Clearly, there'll be some distinctions. I imagine there'll also be some overlap,
Just for those who didn't hear, U.S. Army and U.S. Marine Corps and their relative roles, respective roles.
Yeah, I think let me just make a couple of comments. We've got a phenomenal army, and it's designed to be a dominant land army in a land campaign. I mean, it's designed to go to war and dominate on the battlefield. The Marine Corps, U.S. Marine Corps, actually operates along the seams. You know, if you take a look at it, I've tried my best, and I don't think I do a very good job of it, trying to describe the different domains, the ground domain of the Army, the air domain for the Air Force, and the sea domain for the Navy. The Marine Corps, U.S. Marine Corps, actually works along the seams of all those domains. We don't really have a domain. We transit those domains depending on what the crisis is and what the need is. And most of the needs we have are urgent needs. We've been on ground now for 12 or so years. I make no apologies for that because I think we more than did our mission in Iraq, and we're more than doing our mission with our partners in Afghanistan. But that's really not why America has a Marine Corps. America has a Marine Corps to be able to respond today. I mean, something happens today, not 30 days from now, not 40 days from now, not let me cobble together a force and train it. It's today. And that's why forward presence is so critically important to us and as a naval force. So two different missions. I would say just the same way America doesn't need a second land army, America doesn't need a second Marine Corps. And so we have a very specific capability set and talent pool that we bring to a crisis. As we look around the international community, but because the military, to include your army from your country, and I was just with Sir Peter Wall last week in the UK, as we traveled to include the Asia-Pacific area, our size of the Marine Corps and kind of how our ethos and how we do business actually fits pretty well with most of the armies around the world. And I'll tell you, there's an affinity. It's not a fraternal bonding, but there's an ability to be able to say, okay, I'd like you're expeditionary, you're responsive, you're adaptable, you're flexible, We'd like to have a force and build a force that's kind of like that. Or we'd like to fight alongside a force that's just like that. So there's a natural cohesion and an affinity between the United States Marine Corps and many of the world's armies just because of size and really kind of because of our ethos. We're not designed to be a dominant land army. That's not why we have a Marine Corps. My sense is most of the other armies around the world aren't designed to be a dominant land army either. That answer your question?
Okay. Well, General, we're very grateful for your time today, for your 42 years of service. We're all thinking of you and your Marines. Not too many. We're all thinking of you and your Marines all the time, and certainly in the course of Memorial Day weekend and beyond. So we want to thank all of them and thank you very much.
Thank you.